Listen up. I hate to have commercials interrupt this interview, so I'm going to tell you about three sponsors quickly now, and then we're going to go right into the program, starting with Walker Corporate Law. If you need a lawyer who understands the startup world and the tech community, I want you to go to walkercorporatelaw.com. Next, I want to tell you about Shopify. When your friend asks you, "How can I sell something online?" I want you to send them to Shopify and explain to them that Shopify stores are easy to set up. They increase sales and they'll make your friends' products look great. Shopify. Finally, I want to tell you about Grasshopper. Do you want a phone number that people can call and then press one for sales, two for tech support, etc., and have all of the calls be routed to the right person's cell phone? Well, get your number from grasshopper.com. All right, let's get started. Hey there, freedom fighters. My name is Andrew Warner. I'm the founder of Mixergy.com, home of the ambitious upstart. How does a founder bootstrap a profitable business by putting his mission before his product? Michael Radpervar is the co-founder of Holsti, which sells shareable art. They sell things like letterpressed greeting cards that say, "Live your dream," wallets that are upcycled, and a t-shirt that has a pocket in an unusual place, as we'll talk about in a moment. But at the heart of the company is a manifesto that the company says has been viewed over 60 million times. I invited him here to talk about it. Hey, Michael.
Hello.
How profitable is the business?
We're at a point where we're not we have a little bit more I don't know, I guess buffer room than we did before. We started off being we're still very, very resourceful. We have to be very scrappy, but we have space for being creative now. We have been sharing office. We actually, when we first started, we got office space from other people. That's how we literally got off the ground. We went around and asked people if they'd allow us to work out of their office when it's just two or three of us. And as our team grew, we were lucky because our revenue was starting to scale with us and we were sharing space. And I'm actually, for the first time, for the first week, standing in a space that is our own home. And we're really excited about it. We just moved to Brooklyn. And so that's a really exciting time, profitability-wise, when you can be able, when we're able to swing something like that. And so
So
we're
you guys are
still.
profitable, but
We're not
not insanely profitable yet.
insanely pro. Yeah, because
What kind
we're.
of revenues are you generating selling greeting cards and t-shirts, et cetera?
So we do. Last year, for the first time, we surpassed a million, and we're on track to exceed that this year. So we're really focused on doing investments in the future of Holsti right now. So that, of course, is going to impact our profitability. But we see a vision of what we want to create in the long tail, and it's much more than even just shareable art or greeting cards. It's this whole behind me. There's this, our line, which is encouraging mindful living through design, and that's our vision, and that's what we want to create. And we want to approach that from many different facets.
I want to get into what the manifesto says. I've got it here up on my screen and this t-shirt that started it all. But let's talk a little bit about what you did before, just to get a sense of how you got here. There
Sure.
was one day that you were excited about going to work. In fact, you were videotaping yourself as you were going into work this day. Why were you videotaping yourself and what were you headed to do?
So my brother and I had decided we were going to actually go in and give our 2 week notice at that point. We had been working on a couple different projects with our co-founder Fabian at that time, and we realized that we were both in a position at a time in our life where we just wanted change, and we had an opportunity, and it was feasible for us to go in and do that. Fabian was still in school at that time, and we had been talking the night before, and literally on Friday it was just like a crazy idea. By Sunday we had kind of talked ourselves into, "Okay, let's make a pact. Let's do it Monday morning. You're going to do it, yes. I'm going to do it, yes." And then like throughout the whole weekend, one of us was up on it, one of us was down. And by Monday morning, we had locked it down. And I think that we both had this kind of insane nervous energy you get when you're about to do something kind of crazy, but really exciting. And I remember I got to the office and I literally had just set down my laptop and was getting ready. And I got a phone call from my brother. He's like, "I did it. I saw my boss." And I was like, "Oh my God." He's like, "I didn't even put my bag down." I walked right into the office and I was like, "Okay, pressure's on. I better not mess this up because Dave already did it." And, it was, I think, that first week when we kind of, it was, I think we, I remember describing it to each other, or us, when we were talking about it, as almost feeling like we unplugged from the matrix a little bit. It was like, oh wow, this is like not such like a wonderful, you know, it's not like such a, like a, it was a different form of reality. Like we felt like we had much more control, and but also we were much more accountable, because all of a sudden we better make this work now because we don't have those other, you know, a regular income stream, and we had to just really rethink. And we literally went into survival mode after literally that week after that video.
And the company that you worked for, you had a good job, and you got to watch big companies and how they operate, and you also got to watch one of the problems in a big company, which was a cultural issue. What was the cultural issue that you noticed?
In other companies that we worked with, or in general?
Yeah, you were working at a company that wanted to make a change, but the culture didn't jive with the change that they wanted to make.
I think that
Well, here's what I have in my notes, and I was curious about this, and I think it fits in with the direction that you took your company when you finally launched it. It was I was working at a telecommunications company and was on a conference call, and we had been working with them for 3 to 4 months, and they were wondering why we're not seeing bigger results. It was not the problem was it wasn't being supported as a cultural change, the changes that you guys were making.
Right.
They wanted people to get behind a service culture when they weren't even embodying that.
Yeah.
Help me understand that.
This was a really interesting scenario that I think it's a lesson that I'll take with me forever, wherever I am or whatever I'm doing. It was this idea that they wanted to create a true service culture, at least outwardly, to their customers and from call centers or in retail shops. But as we were talking and interviewing people at different levels within the company, we found that it wasn't that they actually didn't have a very good service culture internally in terms of how the relationships between managers or working with middle managers or frontline employees. And what I saw as a pattern in a lot of different companies was when that didn't exist, it was really hard to create an outward service culture because it really has a very strong trickle-down effect. And a lot of times when we saw that there was trouble or not a lot of traction in terms of improving the customer service on like the frontline level, like the actual interaction between the end customer and the customer service or their service employees, if you kind of trace that up within an organization, you can see how that might have happened. But in companies, and I think Zappos is a great example, and they pride themselves on that a lot, they have an incredible internal culture, and that just explodes out into their call centers and into their service culture. So that was something that I think, you know, even as we started our own company, I think that it's a lot within our nature to want to create a culture like that, but it's become, it's something that is definitely very, very clear in my mind.
I see. And this was, you were working at a company called Achieve Global, is that right? And that's where one of your clients was trying to make this change. But when the culture doesn't support the change that they want the people to make, it just falls apart. It becomes very thin.
Right.
Okay. Right. All right. So you quit your job and you had a business idea. Was it just a t-shirt idea at the time?
Yeah, it was just.
What was so special about this t-shirt that got you and your brother to quit your job and partner up with your best friend, Fabian?
I think we all had this feeling that it would be something more than t-shirts eventually, even though we had no idea where that would go or where that would lead. And that was pre even manifesto or anything. We were all very hungry for a lifestyle change. We were hungry to create a life for ourselves that we could do something that was meaningful and fun and work with people that we wanted and in a culture that we were most excited about. And I think that having that unique project, a holster positioned pocket on a t-shirt, was just a vehicle for getting there for us. It could have been anything. It could have been a digital product. It could have been a lot of different things. And I think as we learned more and got into that space, we learned more about the process of making things and creating things and even the impact. If we're a small t-shirt company, we learned a lot about cotton and how cotton requires a huge percent of the world's pesticides, but represents a very small percentage of the world's overall crops. And even if we're going to be creating a very small run, we don't want to contribute that in any way. We want to be very proud of all the ingredients we always use and the way we make things. And that kind of set the foundation for how Holsey was going to grow.
I see. Okay. So I'm going to ask about what the t-shirt looked like, but you're saying, hey, Andrew, we just wanted a lifestyle change and we wanted to do something meaningful in the world. And if a t-shirt was our entry into that new path, then that's what it was going to be. But it's not about the t-shirt.
Yeah.
Okay. But the t-shirt did have something, as I said at the top of the interview, a pocket in an unusual place. Yeah. Can you describe where it is?
So it was literally a holster positioned pocket. I'm sorry if it comes out blurry, but like you can imagine if you put in a pocket right here on a t-shirt. And the first designs were, my brother actually created the first designs and my grandmother prototyped them. And she had since become like our chief prototyper. And even, so she lives in California. She would even come up with all these, even when we weren't there, she would come up with crazy designs for putting like a hidden pocket. We ended up just keeping it pretty simple. But it was just like this idea of having a pocket that was functional. Because at the time also companies like Threadless were blowing up and huge fans of what they've done. But there's been, we thought there might be something interesting about creating shirts that aren't just another silkscreen t-shirt. And maybe there's something we can do around the form or the function of it.
And I see.
And so that's what got us.
Sorry. So it was kind of a functional t-shirt. The pocket was right by the waist where your arm would fall down. So that if you wanted to grab something out of it, you could easily.
And as opposed to like a chest pocket where you bend over and things fall out right away, this you could actually put something in and not worry about it like jumping out.
And is that where the company name came from? Holstie has to do with t-shirt
holster,
and holds.
Holster t-shirt.
Holster.
Yeah.
Got it.
Yeah.
All right. And then Jeremy in the pre-interview asked you, what's the first step that you took? And it basically was you guys sitting together, the three of you, on steps of Union Square. And you were coming up with this, with what you stood for. Mm-hmm. Why do it at that point? Why not say, hey, you know what? Let's just figure out how to make a t-shirt, how to get customers. Once we have a little bit of revenue and some breathing space and maybe our ramen profitable, then we have the luxury of doing a manifesto. Why do it so early?
I think that, well, when we first wrote it, we started doing it more as a personal journey than as a manifesto for our company. It ended up going on the about page of our website because I think we just didn't want to forget it. We wanted to be very connected to it. We sat down and wrote it because we had all just done this kind of crazy stuff. Like Fabian had been giving up he'd been giving up really great opportunities to come and join Holstie, and Dave and I had quit very stable, secure, well-paying jobs that at the time, at some point of our time at those jobs, that was like some type of a dream job in terms of what we were getting. And but we all realized that this wasn't for us at some point. And we wanted to start like, okay, why are we doing this right now? It's 2009, recession is like in full swing. The company I was at just laid off over 100 people, but yet we feel it's important enough for us to go in and totally like disconnect, shake shit up in a time that things are very unstable already. And we wanted to write down, okay, well, what is important for us? And so our prompt was basically, let's define what it means to have a successful life in non-financial terms.
So this was internally for you,
yeah.
And then to keep yourselves accountable, you put it up on the about page, and then this thing, I'll ask you in a moment how it took off, but first, let me make an adjustment here, and I want to read part of this. I'm not going to do it justice, so someone in the comments, please link to the actual image, because it's beautiful in addition to being inspiring, and I'll just read a few sentences. It says, "This is your life. Do what you love and do it often. If you don't like something, change it. If you don't like your job, quit. If you don't have enough time, stop watching TV. And if you're looking for the love of your life, stop. They will be waiting for you when you start doing things you love." That's essentially it. And boy, it's actually giving me goosebumps right now as I read this. And I read it in preparation for this interview. And so the idea was not even to make it look this beautiful. It wasn't to make it an object that was a shareable object, as you say.
We had it on our site just in a text form for like the first 3 or 4 months. And we were literally just getting into this whole space. So the idea of even putting typography to text was something that never occurred to me and my brother, who is much more design inclined. He's now the lead creative officer, I'd say, for Holstie, everything from product design to web design. He suggested that we start looking into getting it, working with a typography designer and seeing what their approach would be with these words. And so we put out some feelers, literally had no cash. And so we're just like, if anyone wants to do this, we'd be really, you know. And we got connected with a great typography designer named Rachel Beresh. They had a couple iterations back and forth. They was like, you know, I was thinking more something like this. And after a while, they came out with what just felt right, felt good. It seems like it had presence and power. It brought significance to the words that were also very important for us. And then we put it on the about page of our website from there. Sorry, I think I didn't answer part of that question though.
No, you did. I was
I did,
wondering
okay.
about the evolution of this, and
Oh,
I see.
right.
It started off as just basic text that made you guys feel empowered and gave you guys a sense of direction, and then someone decided to make it into this beautiful work of art, and then it was shared. How did you come up with this? It's not easy to figure out what you stand for. Some people go
Yeah.
out to India for years or travel the mountaintops and sit and quietly try to ponder it and then don't come
Yeah.
up with anything. How did you figure out what the three of you stood for and what your company would embody?
It was a lot of conver we spend actually even to this day we spend a lot of time talking about exactly that. And even though the having written down a manifesto early on of what is important for us, that really cemented the type of company we want to have, the type of culture we want to have, and even the way that we want to make our business decisions. But it's still a little bit of an evolving process, I'd say. And so we continue to have discussions around why does Holsti exist? What's the purpose of our company? And I think that early on, we wanted to write something down just because for
But how do
us.
you do it? Do you guys just all start brainstorming and saying, look, we'll write down whatever comes to our mind. What do you
Yeah.
stand for? What do you like? I like ice cream. Okay, there are no bad answers. Let's write down ice cream on a piece of paper. What
Yeah.
else do we stand for? Well, quitting your job if you're not happy with it. That's what we did, and we recorded ourselves going into work to do that. Great, put that down. What
Yeah.
else?
I
Is that
think
it?
I well, you know, I think that a lot of people a lot of times ask, you know, how do, you know, what was what did you how did you guys create this? I'd love, you know, how did it spread the way that it did? And I think that the most important thing is like, don't write it for anyone else. Write it for yourself. Don't write it in hopes with the intention of it going well, because that's the like absolute recipe for it not happening, I think. Be authentic and really just challenge yourself. Give yourself time and space to think deep and do it with people that you really feel comfortable, like almost like taking that journey on, if you will, like for lack of a better term. And David and Fabian are two of my best friends, and I think that we're all very, very close. And for us, having that discussion together was just very natural. And we all kind of pushed each other and challenged each other, and like, well, why is that important? Or what do you feel about X, Y, and Z? And we would just kind of like bounce ideas back and forth. And it really just started as a mashup of just different values. What are the things that are important for us? And it kind of organically flowed. And I think Fabian was pushing like with a lot of the question asking. I think that's one strength that he brings very strongly to our team. And David was able to, he took a lot of the different words and just like a lot of different lines we had. And I think that he got a good rhythm going with the manifesto. And the whole process overall was like very organic. Nothing felt forced about it because we didn't actually even know what we were writing when we were writing. It was just kind of like, okay, let's just write down the things that are important for us. And it just came together.
There's a sentence right here in the middle. It says, "When you eat, appreciate every last bite."
Yeah,
No one said, "Hey, you know what?
huge.
That's a little too simple.
Yeah.
Let's keep that out."
Food is a huge part of our culture.
It is.
I mean, we make food. One of the most important things in our new office was like have a place where we can cook and have we and even it's not a big space. So kitchen is probably taking up like a fifth of our office space right now.
Isn't that cool when it's your company and you can say,
Food.
cooking
Yeah.
food at the office is important to me. I get to do that. You know,
Yeah.
anyone else, any other job would say that's something you should do at home, but this is my
Right.
company. I get to do that.
Well, we even have every Thursday, we have one person who cooks for the entire team every week, and we rotate that. And we just find that bringing together people around food is so, and I think this is something that's becoming very common, especially within companies of our size. Even larger companies are starting to see like food-centric. Google has a thing, never be more than 150 feet away from food. We're never 150 inches away from food. I don't know. But we have definitely a very strong food culture. We keep food stocked. We're making food all the time. And I think that also started from when we first started our company, me, Dave, and Fabian. We just didn't have money to go out for lunch. So we got a rice cooker, and we found the extent of a rice cooker is infinite, basically, based on your own creativity. We made everything from obvious rice to pasta to pad thai to omelets. And it's kind of been, yeah, it's
All
continued.
right, you got your mission, you got your buddies, you got your first product that grandma helped put together. Now it's time to get some customers. And as I understand it, you were walking from store to store trying to sell your t-shirts to stores. Is that right?
Yeah.
Why that direction instead of the internet?
We were basically trying everything, trying to see what sticks. We saw wholesale as not necessarily the ultimate route they wanted to be in the long tail, but as a brand, like a brand enhancing tool. So like the right stores with the right presence could get us in front of people who might not have just be stumbling upon us online. And so we also thought that as an online company, it's really important to have an experience of getting that like person-to-person feedback. And that would be the best way to get it. And we learned a lot in that process. We learned a lot
What did you
about,
learn from going to stores in LA?
well, I remember we learned a lot about our pricing was, first of all, way off. We didn't really know, we weren't that familiar with like the level of margin people were expecting. And everything from selection size, that if you, a lot of stores sometimes they'd rather have like a large a line to select to choose from rather than having a couple one-offs. And what else? Even the types of fabrics we were using, the colors. It was just great instant feedback from people who do this for a living. They're just buying, they're looking at all different types of stuff and buying for a living. So for us, we were able to take those learnings very quickly and apply it to the next round of whole CTs that we had.
I see. What did you learn about the price?
We learned that we were making probably what was the most, probably the most expensive t-shirt ever made, because we could never get to the price that they needed for wholesale.
What price did
And
they need and what price were you offering it at?
well, they, you know, people, they want at least a 50% margin. So if you're selling a shirt for 30, they want to be able to buy it for 15, which means you better be making a healthy amount before even then. And we needed to cut our costs by like 30 or 40% to even get there. And it really comes down to the fact that we were using materials that were really hard. Like even 3 years ago, the scope of materials that are available now was very different then. We couldn't even find t-shirts that were made from organic cotton that were a good fit. And now you can just walk into any American Apparel and pick up an organic cotton tee. At that time, there were just big boxy t-shirts. So we had to make our own patterns and cut and sew our own that were a
How
good
do you even
fit.
know how to find the material and then how to find someone to do it for you to sew it up?
This was all trial by fire. I mean, we basically went from person to person to person, them saying like, well, before you get to me, you have to talk to this person to about the fabric. Oh, before you get your fabric, you have to talk to this person about the, and before you get to me, you have to like get a pattern made. And so we're like, oh wow, okay, we thought we were like 3 months away from making a shirt. We're actually like 9 months away, or a year. And
It took you 9 months to a year to have a t-shirt made.
when we started doing our own everything from scratch, it took us that long, and that was our first time making it. So we had a lot to learn, but we just kept realizing, like, okay, well, this is going to take a little bit longer than expected. I think if we did it now, we could do it again in half the time and a quarter of the cost, probably. But that was also just a huge learning that anytime you do anything for the first time, it's going to take twice as long, cost twice as much. That's pretty much rule of thumb at this point.
Planet Money, the NPR show, tried to make t-shirts from scratch and show their audience the process. Did you hear
I backed that on Kickstarter. It's awesome.
it? They ended up going to Kickstarter, but they bought their shirts, I think, from Jockey because they just couldn't go through the process. It was too tough to source their own
Oh,
cotton
interesting. I
and
didn't see
then
that.
to have
Wow.
it made. The same thing that happened to you happened to them, except they were going to go all the way back to cotton and then make it from there. And they just gave up. It was too much. They decided to just get a t-shirt from Jockey and tell the story of how t-shirts are made
From
instead
Jockey.
of showing you how
Interesting.
to do it. I think it's Jockey.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, cool.
So it is a really tough process, long, long time, and you quit your job. So how are you supporting yourself?
We got really creative. We cut out pretty much every single type of cost that we could. I don't think I bought a new piece of clothing for an entire year and a half. Was just wearing Holstein stuff, Holstein t-shirts as we were getting prototypes, just wearing those and whatever I had from before. We did everything from just like stopped going out to restaurants almost immediately, and we were starting to cook and realize that you can actually stretch your money very far if you're cooking smart, and you can actually eat very healthy also. We things like Airbnb had just come on the scene. I think we were one of the first people in New York to use Airbnb, and so we got a lot of really great reviews early on, and that helped us to just get a lot of traction. And as a result, we met the founders, Brian and Joe. They stayed at our place a couple times, so that was kind of cool. that was just perfect timing because otherwise our biggest expense in New York, of course, is rent. And so we were able to pretty much eliminate that for the first year.
This is back. They told me that in the early days to figure out their product, they would go and stay in people's homes in New York because New York was so popular for them and ask questions and figure out their product. Yeah. You're one of the homes they stayed in.
Yeah, totally.
And it was the three of you living in the same apartment and also renting it out on Airbnb?
For a while, yeah. There was a time period where all three of us, it was two-bedroom apartments. They were all crashing in one bedroom for a while,
That's crazy.
Yeah.
Let me make one more adjustment.
Sure.
There's an HBO show called How to Make It in America where these guys are essentially trying to get into the clothing business like you. And you watch them for episode after episode, and I just gave up on it after a few episodes. I said, these guys are crazy.
Yeah.
How did you know you weren't crazy? How did you know that this made sense and that this was a real business when 9 months you're not selling?
Yeah. We had other products coming on, so it's not like we had nothing to sell for 9 months. We had a round of prototypes that we did, but we were making pretty much no money for the first like 6 to 8 months, I would say.
So how do you know you're not on the wrong track? Not another guy with it, because there are tons of people with t-shirt company ideas that never went anywhere and should have given up sooner. How'd you know you weren't one of them?
I don't know. We just had this like unbreakable momentum for some reason. We were just so excited to be doing this, and it was summertime when we started, and we just had such incredible energy. And we were working on Holsti like as a side project before, and when we started to do it full time, I think people really changed how. Like in their minds, like how they would support us, because like, wow, these guys are for real now. They're not just like some other side project who want to do this. And a great advertising agency on Fifth Avenue called Arnold NYC put us up there for about a year and a half, and we just got like a great space to work out of. And we just started bartering with people. So even though we didn't have money, we'd say, oh, we have some experience doing some creative work or web design, maybe we can help our pattern maker. We basically helped her to put up a website in exchange for her making a pattern for us. So we were just, I feel like we just did things, and we definitely had these points where we felt like shit was just hitting the fan. We weren't going to be able to get out of it. But we there's a story that Dave tells about how it's like imagine like we were like undersea, right? And we're swimming and swimming and swimming, and you're running out of breath. And then you finally get to a red balloon and you get a little bit of air, and that's just, and then you take that and you swim and swim, swim. And like, you'd always get to the next red balloon at the last second, but you have to like swim like crazy to get there. And the last seconds are the most important to swim the hardest. We definitely had those moments. We didn't think we'd find the next red balloon. But we had a mix of working crazy hard, being very resourceful, and a good amount of luck throughout the process. And we also realized that once we quit our jobs and started Holsti, we can never go back. Once you're unplugged, it was really hard to ever think about going back.
And you wanted a lifestyle. One of the things that I know about you is that you don't have an alarm. You don't need one to wake up. You wake up when. What's the deal with the alarm? I won't tell your.
And this literally started about the time that I started Holsti. Unless I have to like make sure I'm up to catch a plane or something, or I know I have like an early call, I don't really use an alarm. And I found that if I really concentrate, this is going to sound so hokey and ridiculous, but I find that if I concentrate on a specific time, like I need to wake up at 8 a.m. and I know what time I'm going to bed and how many hours I have, I've very consistently just woken up pretty much within like 3 to 5 minutes of that time. And I find that, and now there's all these things that like, getting... quantifying your body, like sleeping patterns and food, and I forgot there's actually like some kind of like phrase
for quantifiable self.
Yes, quantifiable self. So like that's very big right now, and I think that what that's showing is there's times when you want to wake up, there's times when you want to continue sleeping. Your body can regulate that very well. And once I got into this pattern, I just found that waking up with an alarm is really disruptive, and I don't feel that great that day.
What I was getting at there is you are living, as tough as it is, you're at least getting to invent your life and try things like this. And you also, in addition to selling through stores, you said we were trying everything. One of the things you were trying was selling online. Do you remember your first customer from when you sold online?
Well, our first customer, I think, was one of our really good friends from when we grew up in Providence. But I have to actually go back and find, because I remember there was a time when our first customer that we didn't know, and me and Dave and Fabian were all sitting at a table, and an order came through, and we're like, "Whoa, this name is unfamiliar. Do you know this person? No. Do you know this person? No." Like, "Oh my God, someone's buying our stuff just not just because they want us to eat tonight, but because they actually think it's cool." That is a really magical moment
I
for
bet.
any company, I think. You know, when it's no longer just family and friends that are buying your stuff, but other people. That was pretty remarkable.
Who built your online store?
We use Shopify as our back end. Dave and our lead developer Tom, they do all of the kind of the build out. We're next end of this week, early next week, we're going to be releasing a whole new refreshed look that's going to better reflect the direction that Holsey is going in now in terms of just creating encouraging mindful lifestyle
But the
and
whole
creating
thing is built
shareable
on
art.
Shopify.
Whole thing is built on Shopify.
Why didn't you build it yourselves from scratch? Why connect with someone else?
We started off actually, so we did the reverse of what a lot of companies do. We jumped right to Magento thinking we don't want to pay anyone monthly, we want to own this, da 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 da. And we realized pretty quickly that, well, first of all, the developer we were using kind of built half the shop and then we never heard from him again, and we had paid him in full, which is like also things you just learn along the way. And so then we got stuck trying to figure it out, and we brought on some other developers who helped us do it. But even once it was finished, we realized how dependent we were because it's very developer focused. And even when we first started with Shopify, we didn't have a developer. We just brought one on because we wanted to do things that were like much further advanced. With Magento, to do the simplest things, to do like little tweaks, you actually have to have a developer. And at that time, David wasn't coding that much. And we realized that, okay, this it was just really frustrating even to add a new product photo.
I see.
And so we decided at one point, like, okay, this isn't worth the headache. Let's look at other options. We tested Shopify, and we're like, wow, we can actually start to focus on our company now and not like credit card processing and site being up or down or other things. So, and then we've built a great relationship with them, and they've been so supportive and helpful. And so.
One of the challenges that you have is balancing your mission to create great products, but also sustainable products. And there was one issue that you had with a backpack. The construction, by the way, I should tell the audience, you're still doing construction on this brand spanking new office, and you asked the construction people to please pause so that we can record this interview, and I appreciate that. Are they coming back
Totally.
in? I know that we're now at the top of the hour.
Yeah, no, they'll probably be back, I'd say, in like 30 or 40 minutes, yeah.
Okay.
Or yeah, soon.
Plenty of time. So the backpack is a good example of the difficulty of making products that use sustainable material. What happened there?
So it's been David's dream, I think, to build a backpack, design a backpack. We had a lot of different prototypes going. It's one of those products that we were really determined to not use, to only use like our favorite types of materials, the things that we really wanted to see, making our dream backpack, and didn't really want to make so many compromises along the way. You know, for sure, didn't want to use any plastic. We're making it out of like a really nice hemp canvas, which is also not that easy to source in the US, and that's a whole nother topic. But as we started getting prototypes together, again, we realized, like, man, if we want to make this backpack the right way, it's potentially going to be very cost prohibitive, and we're not sure if we're at a point where we can actually scale to make this backpack a cost at a price that we think that makes sense. And so we had it basically going around a prototype, and I think David still wears the prototype backpack to this day, but we'll come back to it maybe sometime in the future. But yeah.
And the backpack would have cost $300 to $400,
Yeah.
and that's partially because to use. Let me see what I have here in my notes. You wanted the backpack. Let's see. No plastic. All hemp canvas. Biodegradable. All natural beeswax to create
Oh, that's
waterproofing.
right, yeah.
In the U.S., though, it's illegal to sell hemp, and to bring it into the country is going to be very expensive. So,
Yeah.
that's the big challenge.
Yeah. It's illegal to grow hemp, and selling it because they import it all is very, it gets very expensive. And I think that right now we're at a point where the tides are starting to turn a little bit. A lot of people are saying that there's a lot of value in growing hemp, and hemp, just to be clear, is very different from medicinal marijuana that someone might smoke. If you tried to smoke just the cannabis hemp that they use for creating apparel, you would get sick or whatever, you know. That's just like, that was a material that we were really interested in. And the more we learned about crops and like which ones are most sustainable and have the least impact, hemp consistently ranked at the top of the charts. And so we were so determined for a very long time to use it. I think we ended up doing a blend of hemp and organic cotton in the last round of Whole CTs that we made. But I think it's something that we'll be hearing more about in the future.
Okay. Hitting the record button again. All right. We understand now the fundamentals of the business. They're in place. You guys have a product that you can actually sell at a price that's reasonable. You got your first customer who you didn't know, and now it's time to really build this thing out. Yeah. How do you go from that one customer who you didn't know to a business that's now doing seven figures in revenue? Where do the rest of the customers come from?
We got very fortunate, I think. The manifesto is what put us on the map in a very big way. And it was funny.
How did
because,
it spread?
I don't know exactly. Well, I know. Okay. I know that it's definitely kicked off via Tumblr. And I remember we were sitting around and we got an email or a message from a friend saying, hey, your company manifesto, I don't even think people were calling it manifesto that much at that time, is blowing up on Tumblr and you should check it out. And so we went and we were really surprised because no one really even knew about our company at that time. And turns out they still didn't, because we didn't write the word Whole CT anywhere on the manifesto. In our words,
from what I can see, it's still not on there. It's just a really nice manifesto. Looks beautiful. It's copied in so many different ways. Doesn't have Whole CT on it anywhere.
Yeah. Well, it depends on which one you look at.
Okay, so you started to add it on later.
You started to add it on, yeah. But okay. So what happened was, I mean, eventually people would. So, and maybe that had a positive impact, because people kind of got curious, like, okay, well, where did this come from? And they started to hunt it down. And, you know, Google, because we had a lot of text, the text on our website, if you typed any of those sentences, it would link back to Whole CT. And, you know, about 300 or 400 comments down, people would be like, oh, it's this t-shirt company in Brooklyn, Whole CT, check it out. So if anyone actually got that far, they'd find out. But it was just insane. Within like a 6 to 8 month period, it went from pretty much people just like coming to our site and commenting on that it was cool to just exploding from Tumblr. It went first Tumblr, and then when it went to Twitter, that's when I feel like it started reaching to different countries, because we'd see people tweeting in all these different languages and it would just have the word Whole CT and then tweet to like Japanese, Russian. And then when it went to Facebook, that was definitely when I think it really just hit a very visible, scalable spot, because also people were then, when you post a photo, and I don't know, there's definitely a lot more visibility around it when it went to Facebook than when it started off on Tumblr and Twitter, and people started changing their profile picture to it, and then shortly after we started getting translations of it from people saying, hey, I came across this and I wanted to share it with my family in Japan, so I translated it, I hope that's okay. And that happened for 14 different countries. People just would translate it and send us a translated copy.
But you didn't do anything to promote it beyond just make it look beautiful and shareable.
We literally had it on our website. I wish, being like the CMO or, you know, the chief storyteller, that like I had some crazy seeding it and like strategically seeding it in places. But this was something that was just put on our website. We put it there from like, it just meant a lot to us, and apparently it meant a lot to other people enough that it just, people felt the need to like want to share it with other people that were important to them.
Here's the thing though, that I think others wouldn't have done. Yes, you had this thing go viral. A lot of other companies have a part of what they stand for or an image that they created go viral and it dies there. But because this is more than just something that you put up on your site, it's what you really stand for. You got to go to speak at conferences. I remember specifically watching you at a conference in DC, and I go, what the hell? Now a t-shirt guy at a tech conference is up on stage? My wife, who's a big do-gooder, goes, oh, no, this is Holsti. Oh, great, a great T-shirt company made from hemp or something. Yeah. What do I care?
Yeah.
But then I heard you talk about the manifesto and heard other people who recognize the manifesto felt like you stood for something that they want to see expressed in their companies, the companies that they work for, that they want to help spread the word about. This idea that you don't just go to work to make money, but you go to work to make a life that you care about for yourself and for other people. And it seems like you started to promote this and to talk about it in a way that other T-shirt manufacturers wouldn't have. Does that seem right, or am I just making too much out of this?
I think that we always saw the manifesto as we were actually very hesitant to ever even to print it or to sell it. We had to almost be sold on that idea by our intern who was just watching our analytics and saying, hey, there's a lot of attention and requests and around the manifesto. We should look into just like we were literally getting like tens and hundreds of requests to print it up and to be able to sell it as a poster. And I think it took us like 3 or 4 months of being like, nah, you know, we're a T-shirt company. I'm not sure that's what we wanted. And when we finally decided to do that, it was a good call. I mean, it became very quickly became our one of like the most requested items on our site.
When you started to do what? To sell it?
To sell it as a letterpress poster. And I think it took us also a while because we didn't just want to do another, like a silk screen, and we wanted to do print it in a very special way. And so we had just been learning about different methods, and that's when we started getting into letterpress printing. And letterpress printing, for people who don't know, is literally when you take a sheet of paper that has that's made out of like a cotton, they typically are made out of cotton rag. It's the type of paper that has like what's called bite. So if you push into it, it has certain parts of it would get indented from a plate that's made. And so you create like a massive plate, metal plate, and it just goes down on each paper. So it's creating a literal imprint on the paper for each one. And that creates a very beautiful effect on paper.
Holy crap. I'm now researching this to try to make a point because I wanted to bolster my statement here about how the message spread and you guys didn't just allow this thing to be a viral thing that spread and got you some boost in traffic, but you allowed it to be what you stand for and to be what other people stood for. And I found this Washington Post article that says how the Holsti Manifesto became the new Just Do It. Yeah. And as I'm reading it, looking for that point to show you, I see a quote from my wife, Olivia, that says, "People do look for meaning in different way in things that they buy now," said social business strategist Olivia Khalili of causecapitalism.com. "They want to feel like, quote, my product can do more than just be a product." And that, I think, is what you did. You didn't just let it go out there as a message. Even she's now talking about it here.
Wow. I didn't make that connection.
So how did you do that? Because I don't want to leave people with the impression that it was all luck. Frankly, it was a lot of luck that people on Tumblr picked it up and started spreading it, that others started to use it on Twitter. But what I notice is you made it bigger than luck. You took this luck and you built on it, but I want to understand how you did it. How did you get people like Olivia to understand that this is a company that spoke for them and not just some random thing that was out on the internet?
I don't know. Maybe I think that it had a lot to do with just maybe the way that we were building our company, the types of things that we were putting out into the world. In terms of creating awareness, or in terms of my role as like chief storyteller, I have two, since day one, I've had two things that were really important for me. The first thing is create awareness. And the second one is to create goodwill, or to generate goodwill, basically.
So how do you do that?
And I think that comes more from the different types of the initiatives or things that you do as a company, or the messages that you put out into the world, or the actions that you take that are not necessarily just related to selling your products, but everything around that.
Give me an example of how you do it. I want the person who's listening to us who says, hey, you know what? I stand for something in my business too. I quit for a reason, and it wasn't just because I didn't like my cubicle. It was because I wanted a life that I was passionate about and this message that I want to spread around the world. Great. They write it down. Now, how do they get people to hear about it, to feel it, to understand it? What did you do as a chief storyteller that got people
We did a lot of different kind of wild things. We did everything from from printing out bookmarks and putting them into all the bestsellers and Barnes and Nobles, just with messages like "Read more, learn more, change the globe." And that was like the way we tried to do like some guerrilla marketing too. On Black Friday, we 2 years ago we actually decided to shut down our website on Black Friday, rather than, you know, it's so common for every retailer to try and compete on having the lowest price and sell, and we realized that that's kind of the antithesis of why we created Holsti. And even if we're going to take a big revenue hit, that was the way we wanted to respond. And okay. I think that, you know, things like, I think there's a lot of different ways to approach something like that, but we took a very, I think probably a non-conformist approach to a lot of the very, we took very atypical decisions to typical situations in a lot of
now
ways.
Now I'm seeing some of it. I don't know that the Barnes & Noble thing would have gotten you, and you tell me if I'm wrong, a big big response. But I do see Black Friday, your Black Friday response in Good Magazine.
Yeah.
That this is something that they're especially proud is going on. And from others, buypositively.org seems to have talked about it and other sites. What else did you do that got that spread the message that, of what you stand for?
We even did things like, we did a line of, and this was, we didn't make any money off of this. This was just like a fun project. And it was funny to adding another project we're not making money off of at a time when we weren't actually already making money. But things like we did a line of upcycled t-shirts where we went to the Salvation Army, picked up a lot of different t-shirts of all different sizes. They actually already had prints on them. And we thought it was really fascinating to explore the idea of those shirts of the Salvation Army have a way better story and have lived much richer lives than some like stale shirt they pick up at the Gap, and for that reason they're worth more. And so we made three different silkscreen prints and printed them right over the design, or you know, like next to or around the design that was already on those shirts. Oh, there's like four trucks driving by right now, sorry.
Mm-hmm. Let me make an adjustment while we...
Okay.
Great. Okay.
And so on those shirts, we had everything from a print that says everything has a story to something that just says fuck fast fashion, and all the F's were blocks. And I don't know, I think just like doing things that are out of the box.
Where'd you sell these t-shirts, or how did you give them out or promote them?
We sold them on our site, and we got into like some early stage really good press about it. And I think that's if we had just continued to do our specific one, it just things like that. And there's actually a lot of different things that fit into that scope of just doing like small projects or side projects or initiatives, that are more about generating goodwill and less about trying to drive a specific sell.
That's what I'm getting at. That's, you know, what I don't see enough about you guys online, that it's not just that this manifesto exists and it's spread and now people are buying t-shirts. It's that you express it in all these different ways. So now I've got to find out, how do you do it? No, in fact, before I even get to how do you do it, mm-hmm. you're a guy who's coming up with creative ways to use a rice cooker, who's bringing people into a two-bedroom apartment, which three of you already are in, to make money. Don't you at that point say, I don't have enough money to live right now. Let me just get enough to buy my own space or to feel like I don't have to eat out of a rice cooker, and then I could do these projects that are fun. Wait for the responsible moment. Why didn't you do that?
I think that none of us felt like there was anything we were missing at that point. Like, this was exactly – we were literally – and I think one of our family friends, Sally, always said it the funniest – said the best, that we're the happiest people – just eating, there's no one happier to eat like rice and beans every day. And like, that was literally us. And still, I mean, I think that we're at a point where we're just like, yeah, it would be awesome to have like a little bit more playroom, have a little bit more money. But like, at this stage in my life where I am right now, and I think that we all feel the same way, is we're pretty lucky. I mean, all things considered, we have a life that we really enjoy living. We work at jobs we work at companies that we really believe in. We get to do stuff that's very creative, hands-on, in a collaborative way. And I think that we're from where we've come from, where we've seen other directions other friends go. We see a lot of people trying to move into this direction, even if it means that like you're scaling back on certain things. Those things that we scaled back on that felt like sacrifices at the time have just been very positive lifestyle changes. For example, we stopped taking taxis. Oh, that's a sacrifice. We got a bike, and now we bike, and then we started biking everywhere. That turned out to be like an amazing lifestyle change.
I see. And so you're not saying, damn it, I can't believe I have to eat out of a rice cooker. You're going, I can't believe I get to build this life for myself.
Yeah, I can't believe I get to actually have a delicious home-cooked meal on a very regular basis and that I know how to cook. And I think it's in large part to Holstie that I started to actually learn how to cook because, once we started going, stopped going out to eat, I'd be like, oh, well, maybe I'll start cooking. Oh, what was that meal that I come from an Iran, a Persian family, and we do a lot of very big food culture also. What was that great dish that my grandmother or my mom always makes? Hop on the phone, get the ingredients, like kind of going back to basics. And now I can make 3 or 4 really great Persian dishes. But I don't know if I would have gotten to that point as quickly because I would have just been going out to like checking out awesome new restaurants all the time. And I'm really grateful for that, for knowing how to cook. And that resulted in us just starting to entertain people at our office or at our home much more. And those are things, parts of our lifestyle that we value very high now. And we may not have gotten there without Holstie.
All right, so now can you tell me a little bit about your creative process, the ability to communicate what you stand for through our projects like going to the Salvation Army, buying up t-shirts, knowing what to put on those t-shirts, and then making them available for sale on your site. That makes a statement. That's impressive. Where do ideas like that come from?
They just come from us. I don't know. I think they come up really organically as we're talking about that was a project that made sense at the time. Now and since then we started doing things like we created a fellowship that every month we give away $1,000 to help someone jumpstart their dream. And the whole concept behind this is Holstie is built on this foundation of encouraging people to literally grab life by the horns, take life into their own hands, and do what drives them, what makes them excited. And we have this quote that we say a lot that don't think about what the world needs. Think about what makes you come alive and go out and do that. Because that's what the world needs, people who are alive. And we really strongly believe that. And Holstie has been built around that whole concept. And we think that a lot of different things that we've done in the past, we've always tried to link back to that. And now that we're at a point to be able to do this fellowship, we realize how important that is, and be able to, sometimes there's like a project or a small project, side project someone wants to start, and they just need a small nudge. And it's not that $1,000 is going to help them execute on it, but it might be enough to get the ball rolling in a meaningful way. So things like that, and I think that, so we had our first fellowship, run that every month we do it. The first one went last month, and we thought we might get like 20 or 30 people apply for it. We ended up getting over 100 people to apply for it, and 4,000 or 5,000 people voting later on because we tried to make it as democratic as possible, voting on the winner. And we realized that, okay, this is something that people really are excited about. And that turned into its own, like we didn't actually go out and have to create too much of a campaign around it because people got excited about it and they drove other people to go and apply for it. Then other people came to vote for it. And I think that doing things like that, rather than the very typical, and we still do some ads, some Facebook ads, Google ads, and we're very new to that, and we're still learning about it, but that's generally not what excites me. And I don't think that's what creates long-tail business. I think that creates a sale at that moment, right then and there, but you're not going to get a loyal customer because you had, like, a creative Facebook ad.
Yeah, I get that. Yeah, you're not going to get someone holding up your stuff and taking pictures of it and putting it on their Facebook page unless you have this meaning behind it.
Yeah.
And I've seen people do that with your manifesto. And you also then moved on. We started off with t-shirts and an understanding that this was not going to be a t-shirt business. It was going to be a mission business. I'm looking at your site at shop.holstie.com right now, and I see a lot of letterpress cards. How did you know that that was the right product to build? Where do you get your product ideas?
It's through a lot of, this has been like a very big discovery year for us in terms of like where we want to go. And we recently realized that that it makes sense for us to transition a little bit away from, to do less apparel and moving more towards home goods. And that transition is starting with art, wall art, home art, shareable art. So having printed many posters at this point, we've become very close to the letterpress process. our letterpressers in LA and in Boston are like two of our best friends at this point. We know them. We've hung out with
them.
Who
do you use in LA?
We've had dinner with their friend. Aardvark Letterpress.
That's who I use.
Oh, really? They're the best.
They really are. I was Harry in D.C. I could have found letterpress anywhere in D.C. or on the East Coast. I still went to Aardvark because they're so good. And I watched them make it when I lived in D.C. When I lived in L.A., these guys really are good.
They really take
craftsmen.
Yeah, they're true craftsmen of their trade. And you know, when we started making this poster, it's an 18x24 print, which is a very uncommon letterpress size. And so we definitely want it to be this size. For some reason, we wanted it that big. It's like kind of a ridiculous size to do letterpress. We were like hell bent on getting that size. And so like, okay, well, they know everyone in letterpress. Like we know a couple people who would have a press that would be that size, and they went and going out. They started actually just renting that machine on a regular basis. And that was at the time that we were starting to scale, and we started sending them like larger and larger POs. And so apparently, we didn't find this out till later, but they actually just went out and bought a machine just for that project. And later on, they told us they were so grateful that happened at that time because for some, you know, letterpress has also started to like make a rebound in a very big way recently. And he said when they bought that machine like 3 years ago, they got it when they and then they were looking at like other ones to get. It's cost three or four more times to get it now. So they're like, when you guys started needing them, that was perfect timing because we beat the rush, and now they're like much more expensive. So that's pretty cool.
But I talked to the founder of Minted, Miriam Nafisi, I think. She has a company that creates greeting cards using the model where people design it, their friends and others vote on it. She only makes the card that's got the highest votes. I think that's her process. But one of the reasons why she uses that process is that it's hard to predict what greeting cards people are going to go for.
Yeah.
And you have a problem where you've got a big audience now. They're waiting to see what you're going to sell them. If you create too much and the concept fails, you're stuck. So how do you know what's going to work?
We talk about that a lot. And I think that being an online shop, there's probably much more creative ways that we can start to test products. And we're starting to do that more and more. And I think that Minted has a really brilliant approach. I think we'll see a lot more people doing something similar to that. We've talked a lot about, even at Holsti, about doing more pre-order stuff, Kickstarter-esque type things. And you know, if it gets to a certain point, then we'll run this print.
What's worked for you as a way of testing out your ideas?
We've done everything from we have an inner circle at Holsti, and that's basically some of our closest customers, community members. It's a private group on Facebook, and we just a lot of prototypes, a lot of discussion of early designs. We tend to drop things in there and have like really great discussions about it. Like for example, this is one of the products that we have coming out soon. It's a frame made out of reclaimed wood. Mm-hmm. They're all made in Detroit, and so it has a really great story behind it too, because so Detroit, as everyone knows, going through a mega recession. There's rows and rows of houses there that are basically getting demolished because no one's living in them. They have to almost start from scratch. And so 3,000 homes a year are coming down. And so there's one company called Reclaim Detroit that's going in and saying, hey, instead of taking a wrecking ball, smashing this house and hauling it to a landfill, let's go in and purposely deconstruct it, and we can probably reuse a lot of that material. And so they charge the city the exact same amount, even though it takes them a week or two longer to do it. They go and deconstruct it, and as a result, they're able to. The only reason they can do it is because they come walk away with like $10,000 to $15,000 worth of raw materials they can sell. And so we're using that wood from that house, and it's like this gorgeous Douglas fir wood that you can really not get that easily these days, and we're building it back into these frames, and we're going to be launching a Kickstarter on it soon. The whole idea behind the frame is a lot of letterpress art and prints that people are making are really beautiful now, and it's kind of the antithesis of the Hallmark card, right? Where Hallmark was like the soulless greeting card that is like manufactured for Valentine's Day and I think that there's something really special about sending someone just actual shareable art that means something to you, that happens to have a place that you can write a note or to someone. But when they get it, how cool would it be to have a place that you can actually house it and treat it like art, either hang it up or put it on your desk? And so the design challenge we had was create a frame that bears some kind of, that has significance in the way that it's made and the material that it's made from. It's very easy to put cards in and out of that can help to like represent those cards in a form that actually feels like art. And so things like that is that, so this is going to be our first Kickstarter project. So in light of what you're saying, this is this is the first time that we're doing that model. We're probably a little bit late to the game in that respect, but for this, it makes perfect sense, right? It's like a product that has, we have to hit a certain minimum to be able to do it, where it's a new product for us to do. We're not sure how people will respond to it. We all love it. We've been using it. We've been have a couple of gifts to friends and family to see what they think about it. But it'll be interesting to see what a larger community thinks about it. So.
Okay. And before Kickstarter, what you did to test was go to an inner circle of people whose opinions you trusted, and you said, look, we're thinking of doing this. What do you think? And they say, no, it's lame. It's too big. It's too small. It's
try
beautiful.
This,
whatever
do that.
Your feedback
yeah,
is.
Exactly.
I see. You use this phrase shareable art a lot, and I used it at the top of the interview because that's how you referred to your products when we were just chatting. Why shareable art?
I think there's a lot happening right now with, first of all, just getting something physical, exchanging something physical rather than, right, it's great to send your friend a GIF. It's great to send a GIF as in GIF, not GIFT. It's great to, you know, there's so many different
email.
Yeah, email, et cetera. And, you know, we've gotten to a point where email has definitely hit a saturation point. I can't remember last time my email was below 50 in the inbox, which is like really sorry to everyone who I haven't gotten back to. I'm trying my hardest, I promise. But I think that 10 years ago, you were really excited when you got an email and you heard AOL.com saying, you got mail, and, you know, you got a piece of something in the mail, and you were like, eh, great, another piece of mail. But now it's the total opposite, right? You get one thing in the mail and you're really excited and, you know, you're opening your inbox hoping that you have like not that much email going on. And I think that that's going to continue to, that sentiment is going to continue to grow. So I think that's one side of it. The other side is that the whole feeling of just like getting, of exchanging art and seeing something that, you know, rather than just like greeting cards are one thing, the Hallmark greeting card, I think that's one thing, but when you see a piece of art that really touches you or makes you think of someone, it's really, people want to share that, right? You want to give that to someone and give it to someone in a meaningful way and, you know, probably attach a personal note to it. And I think that there's an opportunity to rethink about what it means to have a card that's designed so intentionally and so purposefully. So every card, so there's a lot of these cards that are behind me, they're probably not very clear, but we've been working with about more than 10, a growing number of designers. So at this point, it's 10, but we're doing almost a new one every month. And we're challenging these are our favorite illustrators and designers around the world, and we're challenging them with one design prompt, which is create art that encourages mindful living. And everyone approaches that in a radically different way. And so the whole idea is that you find something that just like really touches you, and you can then share that with someone else, and hopefully, you know, if the frame gets made, you'd have a place to like keep it in a special spot. And I think there's something really powerful about that, and much more meaningful than other traditional ways that we've had of like sharing and expressing, you know, moments of happiness, moments that was like creating a deep impression on you, wanting to reconnect with people. There's something really special about that. And that's become something that are almost becoming obsessed with. And I think that there's a lot more people there's a growing group of people that I think would be interested in that too. And we'll find out if we're right or not, I guess.
All right. Let me do a quick recommendation here. And then I want to ask you a final question.
Okay. I'm just going to plug in because I'm at 2% battery. I just don't want to die before it ends.
Oh, yeah. Go for it while I talk it up.
Okay.
And the recommendation is since we talked a lot about creativity here and because these words in the manifesto were brought to life and shared because of the creative way that they were expressed, I'm going to recommend that if you're watching this program as a follow-up to it, that you check out Shed Samov's course on MixergyPremium.com, his course about how to be creative. I came to him with this issue where I said, look, I'm not a creative person. I don't know what to do. I'm a little intimidated by your creativity, Shed. What do I do? He said, okay, you like systems. I'm going to give you a set of processes that you can go through to create products. And that's what's there in that course. And if you're also Intuit, actually, not if you're Intuit. I'm also going to recommend that you check out the interview that I did with him. He was so creative that if you look at the comments, you'll see blue people's minds. Shed Samov, get the course, get the interview, and find a way to connect with him. This guy is incredibly creative, and he's good at teaching his process. And all that's available at mixergypremium.com. I hope you guys sign up. All right, so the final question is this. Jeremy in the pre-interview asked you, what question did I not ask you that's important to address? And you told him about this woman who, after, I guess her house was demolished after Hurricane Sandy, and then she found something. What did she find that changed so much?
She wrote this story on the section of, I guess that goes under another initiative that we created that helps to create a little bit of the depth and personality and character of Holsti. She wrote something on a microsite we created called My Life, which is where people can just go and share their stories of like how they grab life by the horns and maybe a tough moment or a challenging moment. And oftentimes it's definitely inspired by the manifesto in some way. And so her house was demolished. She lived out in deep in Brooklyn on a place that was a red zone. She just moved there with her daughter. And they fortunately were not harmed, but they came back to a house that was totally flattened. And so she wrote about how she had just came across, she had just finished, you know, she bought the manifesto and like gave it to her daughter literally just not too long ago. And she looked back at that and she's like, you know, I'm at a point where I can either really feel really sorry for myself or I can just grab, you know, like just like step up and see this as an opportunity to start fresh. And the fact that she would even like connect the Holsti or, you know, those words that we wrote 3 years ago with her in this like insane, unthinkably difficult situation, was so humbling for us. And I think that was one of those stories that our whole team read and we're like, holy shit, like we actually might be having some kind of an impact on people's lives. And that was a really powerful, powerful moment, I think, on our team. And
so this manifesto helped her focus on her community instead of her own problem. And she, as you said, one of many people. I'm now finally checking out mylife.holsti.com. It looks like it's a Tumblr blog full of stories of people who are impacted by the manifesto.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. Congratulations on the success. Congratulations on both the business success and the success you guys have had on touching so many people. And for everyone who's watching, guys, I don't think I could properly describe what this manifesto looks like. Hopefully someone in the comments will link to it on Holsti's website. But frankly, you don't even need to wait for someone in the comments to do it. Just go to holsti.com and check out the art that we've been talking about, the manifesto, and the whole way that their philosophy is expressed through the site, holstee.com. Michael, thanks for doing this interview.
Thank you.
Thank you all for being a part of it. Bye, guys.